Hey there. Welcome to one of our first stories of the podcast. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. In season three, we shouldered up with you and made it clear that this podcast is not for sale. No advertising or outside influence, a sacred and safe space. Starting with season three, we dedicate a poem to one of our listeners that is standing with us as an enabler of our mission. They're doing so by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. To be true to our word, we're going back through some of our earlier content in seasons one and two and removing the segments that we feel may not be congruent with this idea. So enjoy. This story, like every other story on our podcast, is now 100% advertising free. A safe space where you can let your guard down, listen, and notice if something comes up in your soul. If you would like to be an enabler, and we certainly could use your help, visit bellystory.com and chip in $5 today. Now, here's that extraordinary life story.
As the stock dropped, it was just like watching myself get devalued.
This podcast is about the time we all get knocked down in life and climb up a new person. Listen for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Let me introduce you to Marcus Siegel. The dot-com bubble was a period of time when the internet was booming, and companies offering everything from pet supplies to streaming music went down the drain almost overnight. Marcus was an executive at eMusic, one of those startups. Marcus's story is one of becoming aware of the inner critic in our life that blames us for failing and limits our beliefs in what's possible in ourselves. He would later serve as chief operating officer for Zynga, helping take the gaming company from dozens of employees to thousands. Marcus Siegel, welcome to Belly of the Beast Life Stories.
Thanks for having me.
So take us to the time in your life that sort of wraps around this belly moment for you.
Sure. So it was about 21 years ago. I was living here in Los Angeles. I was 26 years old, and I was working as a television producer. And I was pretty successful for my age. I mean, I'd worked my way up and become an executive in charge of production at this independent production company making documentaries for the History Channel and A&E. And I bought a home, and I seemed to be doing everything right. And I worked a lot. I've always loved working. I'm really a workaholic and found a lot of identity in what I do. Then my father died. Not my amazing stepfather who raised me, but the biological father who, in my case, was bipolar and neglectful to the point of abuse when I would visit him. And we were not close. We were estranged. And the experience really rocked me. I had to make the call on pulling the plug. My sister and I had to make that call. And, you know, we hadn't seen him in years, and it was a mess. And then I went back to work as if nothing had happened, but something had happened. My worldview was shaken, and I didn't have the tools to understand what was going on with me. So I did what I always do, which is I worked harder. And I became unhappy. I became dissatisfied with all that I had achieved and was achieving. And I decided the best thing to do then was to get an MBA at night on top of running this production company. And then about 6 months into that, I was really not happy. And so I decided I needed to blow up my life. At the time, this is 1998, and the dot-com boom, Web 1.0, was really kicking off. You were reading about internet millionaires and these you know, women and men changing the world. And I decided that I wanted to be a part of what was next, that I didn't want to continue to spend my life telling the stories of what other courageous people had done in the past in these documentaries, that I wanted to be a part of what was next. So I started looking for jobs in Silicon Valley. And I was able to find a job at a director level at a startup. Taking this job involved taking a 30% pay cut, moving out of my beautiful home and into a shoddy, dark, dank apartment in Mountain View, not far from the Caltrain tracks, with a roommate. And I did it, and everyone thought I was crazy. But I decided this is my big bet. So I go to the company, and things are going really well for me. We are emusic.com, which still exists, incredibly. We were the first site to sell downloadable music and pay artists the royalties, so completely legal. The company went public. A VP of human resources left, and I was tapped to take on that role. So now, boom, I'm a tech executive, which was really incredible because I majored in English literature in college. I had never written a line of code. And I was just hungry, and I just worked all the time. And I was just thrilled. But I wasn't really paying attention to what was going on. Soon, it all kind of started to come apart, but I didn't really see that happening. A company called Napster, you may have heard of it, they came out, and suddenly, we were paying artists the royalties and licensing the music legitimately, and then Napster came out, and everything was free. So at that moment, eMusic was selling lemonade, and Napster was giving away beer. I see your smile, David, which leads me to believe that you drank that beer. And because you drank that beer, I had to fire a bunch of people, David. But that's what happened. I had to lay off a bunch of people.
So what year is this?
This is now like late 99, 2000.
Okay.
And a couple more executives leave. But I'm loyal and I stay, and I sort of saw that chaos as kind of opportunity zone for me. More executives left. I took on more departments. I got promoted. I became the COO. I moved into a nicer place with better roommates. Not much longer after, I got a sizable increase in stock options. And I thought, wow, I better go buy a place. Look at me. I'm a kick-ass tech executive.
Mm-hmm.
So I buy a condo at the peak of the market. What was the peak of the market then? Napster gets shut down. I mean, it had to get shut down, right? It was too good to last. Free music for everyone. No one gets paid. And our stock went back up. But then the courts, incredibly, gave them a reprieve, and Napster was back on. And that was it. The investors lost all patience with us. The stock dropped like a rock. It dropped below 99 cents a share, dropped below a dollar, which is the threshold where at any moment NASDAQ could decide to delist you. Game over. So we had to make deep cuts. I had to lay off more people. My great job of being the COO of this tech company became a job of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. The stock went down to 53 cents a share. It looked like all was lost. And then we got acquired by Universal Music. And I thought, I'm going to be back on top. I'm going to have an even bigger job in a bigger company. Look at how well it's all going to work out. And then a month later, Universal Music gets acquired by a French water company called Vivendi, and they become Vivendi Universal. And then I'm told, actually, we're going to be shutting eMusic San Francisco down, moving the remaining IP and a handful of people, like four or five people, down to San Diego. You're not coming. So then I facilitate all of that.
I don't want to just blow through all this.
Yeah.
Because I'm sure it was like a really intense
sure
moment in your life. So I first want to talk about your dad.
Okay.
And your relationship with him, because you said it was kind of all over, but yet it was a catalyst that sort of shocked you and mm-hmm. forced you to change your life mm-hmm. in a lot of different ways. And first it was business school, but ultimately that wasn't the right fit. So then it was, moving to Silicon Valley to work in a startup at like a huge pay cut, but for whatever reason. So what was it about your relationship with your dad
Yeah. I've thought about this a lot over the years, and I think essentially calling it daddy issues would be is sort of a, you know, a little bit too broad of a brush. But essentially, I had something to prove. I needed adoration and love and respect. And the way that you got something like that in my family's got is just loaded with overachievers, is to achieve. And school was never my thing. Work was my thing. Like, work involved getting pats on the back and promotions and chances to level up, demonstrable improvements in your life as a result of hard work. Like, the idea of the meritocracy really held great sway with me.
Yeah. So, like, the rite of passage for you was to work.
Right? That's right.
Yeah. So, but you said you had a stepdad who loved you and gave you a lot of that, right?
Yeah. I mean, my mom and my stepdad, Larry, they're fantastic people, and they both work really hard. I suspect that they had similar upbringing where, you know, accomplishments were acknowledged and, you know, pursuing work to the point of obsession was totally normal, probably normal of their parents too.
What is it about work?
There's something beautiful about work when you find the right work. You know, when you're just all in, when the story of what you're working on lines up with your values, lines up with your passions. I mean, I've had periods of time where I work 60 or 80 hours a week for months on end with a smile on my face every day. And I've even been surrounded by other people who feel the same way. I mean, that's certainly how it was with Zynga. We were just so excited to be in that moment of creating something new and bringing it into the world that it just, the idea of work-life balance, work was my life.
Mm.
And in work, I found my balance.
Are you distanced from your emotional self?
I think less so now, but then I was not particularly aware. It was sort of like I had blinders on.
Yeah. When you talk about your crucible, you kind of talk about this period of time,
mm-hmm.
right? And being, I mean, honestly, you're like really shining in work. You keep getting promoted at eMusic, et cetera. And yet it's your job to sort of fix this mess.
Yeah. And it actually gets worse. You know, I couldn't fix the mess. In this case, fixing the mess was keeping the lights on long enough for someone to acquire it. What happened next? After the French Water Company bought this company, and this is really for a person who is as driven as I am and as compulsive and anxious as I am, ceding control, big corporate forces able to exert this kind of change on my life was new, and it was not something that I was emotionally ready for. I mean, there's, you know, now I understand, you know, death hangs like a knife and every day is precious and these things. But, you know, back then I was, you know, my late 20s or early 30s, and everything just seemed so shocking. And how could this be? After the company got moved to San Diego, I had to go to a 50,000 square foot empty office every day for 6 months. I was waiting to get laid off because I had a severance package. And once I had the severance package, then I could figure out what to do next. It was a lot of money. And I would email them and call them and say, hey, I'm here. Like, fire me. Like, start the process. And they just wouldn't respond.
Were you the only employee?
Yeah. I was the only employee.
50,000 square
foot. 50,000 square foot empty space. And I would show up every day and there was a camera. And I believed that if I didn't, I became paranoid. I believed that if I didn't show up, that would be cause. And that cause would be what they would use to not pay me my severance.
So you were COO at the time.
COO of a 50,000 square foot empty building.
So it made sense that they kept you around. Top operations guy.
Sure. And so I sat there every day in an office, you know, reading, you know, trying to figure out. Then they turned the internet off. I mean, it was a nightmare. And I was starting to talk to recruiters about finding another job, but the stink of .com failure was on me, and the whole of the internet all of the tech companies were starting to hit the wall. So there wasn't work.
This is certainly strange. It's almost like one of those TV shows on Netflix,
mm-hmm.
like sort of another parallel universe.
In the end, finally, and it got really dark. You know, it felt like my inner critic and karma got together and just decided to fuck with me. You know, why did I leave my career? Why did I tell so many of my friends and family that this startup was something that they should definitely put money in at $10 a share? Why did I do that? Why did I think that without any experience in tech that I could work as an executive in tech? How cocky I was, right? How wrong it was for me to do that. I mean, it got dark. Why did I buy the condo, right? That was dumb. I kept telling myself that everything I did was wrong and that I had it coming because of my lack of foresight. And wasn't it obvious? All these other executives that had quit, they were the smart ones. In the end, I drove down to LA without an appointment, showed up at Universal and demanded that somebody see me. I thought there was a big conspiracy. The truth was much worse. The truth was that no one cared. The truth was that this, what I thought was a large sum of money that was going to help me get on my feet, the suit that met with me, he said, "Don't worry about it. It's frictional loss." That's what I was to them, frictional loss. And it was shattering. And then once I had the money, then the story I had told myself, well, once you have the money, you'll figure it out. Then I had the money, but I had no idea how to figure it out.
Were you feeling like a failure?
I felt like a failure, a clown, a fuck up. I had been successful in television. The idea of going back felt like tail between the legs. You know, people had told me I was crazy to do it, and I didn't want them to be right. I mean, I was considering moving to Japan and just teaching English. Like I really wanted to be far, far away from the failure that I thought my life had become.
Was this the first failure for you?
I mean, there's lots of little failures, but this was, I think, the first professional failure that I had for sure.
It definitely feels like a big one.
It was a big one, and it felt public. Like that kind of failure felt public. And the thing about this kind of failure is it's not like, it's a unique failure because when you work in Silicon Valley and you work for a publicly traded company, your stock price becomes, it's public. And so people check it. I'd go to the dentist and my dentist would say, "Woof, stock's not looking so great, is it?" And so it was basically as the stock dropped, it was just like watching myself get devalued and having to show up every day and pump up the employees and convince them that I still believed became a big part of my job. And I really kept believing because I wanted to believe. I needed to believe for too long.
I'd love for you to sort of pick it up at the spot where you're now talking to the individuals who own this company, which is a company of you. And what happens?
Yeah, I mean, basically, I was stuck. I needed to get terminated. I actually, at this point, I was depressed, and I was a depressed person who needed to be fired. My job was sitting in an empty office all day. It was killing me. And so I drove down to LA without an appointment. I just showed up and I said, "Hey, you need to fire me. Like something needs to happen here." And they cut me a check. And the check, I mean, I guess in absolute terms, it was a lot of money, but it was less than 6 months of runway for me. And, you know, the dot-com bubble burst meant that condo I bought was underwater. And so now I was looking at, you know, bankruptcy. I was looking at every possible option. I could only see bad things happening. I could only see dark clouds.
So what happened?
I decided that I needed to take a trip, that I needed to get away from San Francisco to break the routine. Because every day that I woke up and didn't have a job was a sad day for me. So I went to Paris And I tried to eat my feelings for a while, and then I went to Morocco.
I want to go back real quick. Did you feel like toxic or like you were wasting your time, or why did you feel like you had to get out of San Francisco?
When e-music was humming, every minute of every day was spoken for. I would show up for work and I had one meeting after another, and we were achieving and we were working together. Then I had 6 months of sitting in an office by myself, and that brought me way down. Now I was just going to sit in my condo that I didn't know how I was going to afford, looking for jobs that weren't there, just down on myself. And I needed to get out of there.
Yeah, so you needed some movement.
Needed some movement. And travel is always a great option for that. Sometimes it's just good to get perspective.
Okay, so where'd you head?
I landed in Marrakesh. And it was really like being in an Indiana Jones movie, you know, snake charmers and all that stuff. But I decided I wanted to really change my perspective to really see a different way of living. So I decided to head out into the Sahara Desert and stay with nomads. There's an outpost where you can go and you can have this experience that I had read about in Lonely Planet. And I went out there and I met up with a man named Hussein and his son and went out on a camel. And it was beautiful. I mean, it looked like Tatooine from Star Wars. And we basically headed out into the vast desert. And after a few hours camel ride, we ended up at his tent, which was a kind of a beautiful tent made out of old rugs. And it was just him and his wife and their son and daughter.
In the middle of the desert.
I was shocked by the way that they lived. I mean, they were really happy people, but this was really hard living. I mean, there was no one else in sight out there. We were really alone. And that night, there was a sandstorm, and they wouldn't stay in the tent with me. They slept outside. I don't know if it was because of his wife and the daughter or what, but they refused to come inside the tent. And after the sandstorm died down, I went outside, and the sky was completely clear. It was a starry sky like you can only see in a place like the Sahara Desert where there's no light pollution. And I remember I laid down on my back and I looked up at the sky and something just clicked. Something clicked. And I realized that this whole thing, this whole being alive thing is so special and miraculous that I could have just as easily been born to this family. It's, you know, we're just energy. And I realized that I had an attitude problem, that I needed to climb out of this. I realized that happiness is a choice. I realized that I needed to choose happiness, that I needed to change my perspective. I realized that I believed I had no options. I couldn't go back to LA and be a TV producer because that would be, I'd have to embarrass myself. What a wonderful option that would be to go be a TV producer again. I didn't want to go back to San Francisco and try and be a COO for another company because I felt like a failure. Well, wait a minute. I had learned a lot. Didn't I actually achieve a bunch of things? Wasn't it actually really hard to figure out how to land that plane and get that company through that crisis? That was really hard stuff. Didn't the people that worked for me love working for me? Essentially, I realized that my inner critic was just an asshole. And that asshole needed to be reckoned with. And that's when the healing began. I knew that the rest of my life was my own. My father may have greatly affected the first 25 years, but he was not going to dominate my thoughts for the next 75.
Can you tell me more about this inner critic that you're talking about?
I mean, I think, unfortunately, I think that's kind of part of the wiring of being a human. My inner critic is just a putz. I mean, this is not a person I would ever hang out with. Like, can you imagine? Can you imagine if you had a friend that talked to you the way your inner critic talks to you? Like, what kind of a friend would tell you, you know, hey, you know, that you look fat in that shirt? Like, what kind of friend would tell you that? What kind of friend would tell you that you don't deserve the success you have? Or what kind of friend would make you doubt your decisions? What kind of friend would do that? That's no friend. And so, you know, I think that there can be some value to the inner critic, but not, it's It's mostly noise.
So self-talk?
Self-talk.
Yeah, okay. So it sounds like yours has been a big part of your life.
Definitely. My inner critic's been a big part of my life, a constant pain in the ass companion. But you know, like a lot of us, as we get older, we say goodbye to certain people. Just because you've known them a long time doesn't mean you have to know them forever.
Okay, so you became a surprise. You started a startup.
That's right. I became a founder of a startup.
And it was successful, and you're becoming sort of a mentor and very helpful to other founders as well.
Well, actually, the startup wasn't immediately successful. It was immediately hard. And a lot of, you know, the first couple of years of a startup, you don't have product market fit and you're trying to figure out exactly what you ought to be doing. But in this case, you know, it was mine. You know, my friends and I got together and we built this thing and we were proud of it. And it was in that work, in meeting all those startups, that I ended up becoming friends with Mark Pincus, who really later gave me the best job that I've ever had.
Okay. So looking back at your career and these jumps and these shifts and all the failures and successes and everything else, I mean, what are the key insights that you've gleaned if you were to sort of pick out a handful?
There's a great quote from Viktor Frankl. He says, between stimulus and response, there's space. And in that space, there's choice. And so what I've learned to realize is that what my inner critic or what did you call it? Voice talk?
Self-talk.
Self-talk. My inner critic or self-talk isn't reality. If it doesn't serve me, I don't have to take it on. And that's a practice. So I think that's been a big help. I think the most important thing, though, is really, if you're going to beat yourself up, use a pillow, not a baseball bat. Because it's not like you've been alive before. I mean, maybe you have, but I have no memories of being alive before. This is my first shot. And I'm learning as I go. And it doesn't do me any good to beat myself up with a baseball bat.
So how do you use that experience specifically when you're like helping other people? Like, how do you point back to that?
Which experience?
Sorry, your e-music experience.
I mean, I think that basically having that ability to see where somebody is, you know, to basically understand this job might be meaning more to this person than just punching the clock, right? That this job might be part of their identity. And in that knowledge, you know, as a manager of people, for instance, if someone comes in to have a meeting with me and I'm grumpy because I haven't had my coffee, that person might go home and tell their partner, "Oh, I really bombed this meeting with Marcus today. You know, I hope I don't get fired." And I think that's something that you have to be aware of as a manager of people, that you actually have this other thing going on where you're someone's boss, right? But I think more than anything, we all just need to be kind to each other. You know, if you're managing people, you should know where they want to grow and what they want to be and see how you can enable that.
And your jobs since that point, right? So like the stuff you were doing most recently and otherwise, has your mindset shifted at all? Like thinking that there is the possibility that this could go away very quickly?
You know, when I was a kid, my mother used to tell me, never let God know you're having a good time. You know, if we're in traffic and if we're driving down the freeway in LA and there's no traffic and you're like, wow, mom, there's no traffic. She's like, shh, don't say anything. Don't let God know you're having a good time. And so I used to really live by that. And I was afraid to really enjoy the highs for fear of a big rock falling from the sky on me. I don't live that way anymore. Life is to be celebrated. Celebrate it all. Live it all. Drink from the fire hose.
All right. So what are the things that you're working on now?
Sure. Thanks for asking. I started designing wristwatches recently. And so if you go to www.watchco.com, you can check out my watches. My watch brand is called Who Dares Wins. And it's really about living your fullest life and about pursuing your passions and being deliberate about your time.
Do you feel like you've lived that way?
I'm always trying to live that way, you know, and I encourage everyone to really try and live a deliberate life. I mean, that day out in the desert, I realized that I did not have a dream. I didn't have a dream for my life. I kind of had blinders on. I realized that I wanted to achieve, I wanted to work on things in my life that I cared about. And I hoped to earn enough money that I would be able to never have to work for a jerk, and that I would be able to travel and these other things. But more than anything, I just wanted to be connected and love what I'm doing. And so right now, I'm definitely enjoying mentoring startups. I'm enjoying designing products. I don't have anything to complain about.
Marcus, thank you so much for telling this story with us.
Thanks for having me.
What an extraordinary life story. If this story moved you, help enable our mission and keep this advertising-free podcast going by chipping in $5 at bellystory.com. I'm responsible and accountable for this podcast, but I don't do it alone. Milos Brochetta is our sound engineer. Artie Wu is our advisor, and many others have helped along the way to bring the story to life. Thank you for listening. I'm David All, and this is Belly of the Beast Life Stories and Beyond. Thank you for rating and reviewing this podcast on Apple Podcasts and sharing it with a friend or two. Stay tuned. I'm working on some stories that you need to hear.